Hello, everyone. Welcome to the second episode of the CEDH cast. My name is Ian. I am one of your hosts. And with me, as always, is my co-host, Braden.
Hi.
All right. So before we start our episode, we have a few patron shout outs to talk about. We normally do a shout out every episode, but unfortunately, a certain member of our podcast forgot to inform me of that last episode. So we're going to do two today.
Yeah. Sorry, guys. All right. So we have one patron who is for the official patron tier, and his name's Walt. So thanks, Walt, for being an official patron of the CEDH cast. We really appreciate your support.
Thanks, Walt.
We also have for our competitor Patreon tier, we have Dominic Graff. So thank you, Dominic.
Thank you very much.
It's very much appreciated.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of patron support we've gotten for the cast already really has been overwhelming in the best of ways. We didn't expect to sort of receive as much feedback and as much response as we have at this point in the cast. So thank you all very much. It's been really great, and we love to see the Discord's really active, and when we'll give you the location of that later in the show.
Yeah, if you have any questions about how we're using the money as a patron or someone who's interested in being a patron, feel free to ask. There's stuff like the SoundCloud and other things like microphones that we have to figure out. So just ask us about it if you want.
Awesome. So this episode is going to be a very special episode. We have an amazing guest from the CEDH community, the prolific Shaper Savant. For those of you that don't know Shaper, he is perhaps the most important deck builder we have in the CEDH community.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be on your cast.
Shaper has been around for about 6 years, and that's basically the most a lot of people have been playing CEDH, seeing as the format's only a certain amount old itself anyways.
Yeah, I think the format is about that old.
Yeah, we have this amazing guest, and to introduce you to some of his accomplishments, let's take a look at some of the top decks in the format that he has helped create. We have first the Food Chain Sliver, Scepter Thrasios, the common reanimator deck known as Razakats, Opus Thief, the wheel control deck, Yisan, and as we recently found out, his baby is the Harvest Animar deck.
Shaper is also well recognized as a community organizer and a mod on the CEDH Discord and Reddit. So if you've ever been on any of those resources, you've probably interacted with him some amount.
And as far as primers go, every single one of the decks I mentioned a second ago has a primer that was written by him. So a lot of the written work done in the primer community is related to him.
And the reason that we have Shaper on this week is because we're going to be talking about one of the resources that Shaper actually manages, which is called the library. Shaper, would you like to talk about the library?
So the library is a Discord server that's a directory to other Discord servers related to each individual commander that people brew around. Essentially, it's a portal to the CEDH universe in which we coordinate with other people that are working on the similar projects to what we're working on.
Sweet. That's really exciting.
The library is broken down into a couple sections. There is the first section, which is just kind of the main area where people can have general talks and submit any sort of primers or discords that they want introduced into the library. There's the Discord directory, which is actually pretty amazing because it's broken down by color and has some other miscellaneous items thrown in there. There's a primer section, which is basically the primer to any relevant competitive EDH deck there is. And there is a really amazing section that has almost every single CEDH content creator there and referrals and information on how to absorb their content. So the first topic we're going to talk about is actually the primers and describing what is a primer for a competitive deck. A primer can be broken down in a few different ways, but at the very base level, it is like having a handbook to describe exactly how to pilot a competitive deck. Braden, do you want to go more into detail with that?
Sure. So often a primer talks about certain key card choices, certain cards that might be missing, certain decisions that often come up while piloting a deck, maybe the history of how the deck was constructed and what other archetypes the deck used to be in or what other archetypes have bounced off of the deck. So an example might be the history of how the current Consultation Scepter Thrasios deck used to be the Paradox Scepter deck. And maybe before that, they were more Storm-based decks. A primer might talk about that and kind of explain that process to give some amount of context for how the deck got to be where it is.
Shaper, I have a question for you. What goes into, in your humble opinion, a primer worth putting on the library? What do you look for?
I normally look for gameplay exposition, the main win conditions and synergies in a deck, the history of the deck, the elucidation of the main synergies of the deck, generally some single card discussion about what would appear to be odd choices to an onlooker.
Great. Specifically, the single card discussion, I think, as someone who absorbs many primers, as many decks as I play, I read up on probably five times as many. And I think the single card discussions are quite important to the viewer who doesn't know a deck well enough, and especially one who hasn't seen it play. You know, a lot of content creators are doing their best to give a lot of competitive decks light, but sometimes it's not there. And primers are really good. The other day I was looking at the Niv-Mizzet Perrin deck and wondering why there was a Spellskite in there, you know, and they have a whole discussion on that, and or a card like Snapback, which is a card I've never seen in a competitive deck, but he went into a great explanation there as to why specifically that card was good in that deck.
I love Snapback. The card's one of my favorite pet cards.
That does not surprise me.
A primer should usually contain all the information you need to pick up a deck for the first time and be comfortable taking into a game and knowing what your general game plan is, how to execute it, how to mulligan the deck, and kind of what you're looking to see in a game and how to leverage it to your advantage.
Shaper, are there any primers that you're especially proud of or you think are especially useful for new players or people who might be looking into writing their own primers?
I think the Scepter Thrasios primer is pretty clearly laid out and is a good example of a well-put-together primer. I think my Harvest Animar primer is well-written and has a lot of interesting lines in it. I think the Razaketh's primer is probably my most advanced primer. It has a lot of interesting Razaketh lines in it that can teach you a lot about the way that triggers work and that sort of thing. I think the original Chainveil Teferi primer is one of the best primers that I've ever written. It was written by Siggy, aka Lobster, of Laboratory Maniacs fame. It had explanations of how to play games with different pod compositions, whether you'd want to go slow, want to go fast, you'd want to play a control game versus a value-oriented game. It was overall really well written.
And I know through the power of primers, I've definitely piloted decks that were extremely advanced, as if I were a competent pilot already just because I had done my homework on the deck.
And I think one angle that a lot of people enter the format from is they might find a commander that they're passionate about or an archetype that they think they want to try to test out. And some people kind of get the impression that they might think they're like too good to read someone else's primer. But I think one of the most interesting things for people like that is that a lot of times these primers talk about certain situations and card evaluations that you might not typically question on your own in a vacuum where you're the only person trying to improve your deck. But once you read a primer, you'll get the opportunity to hear someone else's perspective on a card, and it might make you think completely differently. So if you're the type of person who typically doesn't go online to read about primers, I think that's something you should start looking into, especially if you've been playing a deck for a very long time.
I think primers are one of the most important information relays that we have in our community.
100%.
Really lets people who have a lot of expertise with a deck or an archetype transmit a lot of information in a very short period. The people that write them are some of the most knowledgeable people about that strategy, and you'll get a lot from their expertise that they want to targetedly share.
One thing I've noticed is that the CEDH community, I feel, more aggressively pushes people towards writing primers than maybe other formats.
Yep.
In Standard, I'm not sure there's like a Mardu Tokens, if that's a deck even in Standard, but in Standard there might not be a Mardu Tokens primer, you know, the deck is constantly being figured out. But in CDH, the community is kind of built in such a way that people actually come together and like write these primers, and I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I've been playing 60 card formats basically since I started Magic, and I think I legitimately saw my first, I mean, there are deck articles that I've been reading forever, but the first legitimate primer I've ever seen for a Standard deck was on Twitter the other day. I would say the 60 card version of a primer is a sideboard guide. But for us, our entire format is basically a sideboard, right? So
yeah, I guess those types of options don't actually exist in the format, so maybe that's why it's more important.
Right.
I think a lot of that is the complexity of the win conditions and the variance that you have over a 99 singleton deck.
Yes.
Yeah. Also, I feel like card choices are much more important in our format because you only have one of every card. You don't see a lot of single card discussion about like Lingering Souls, you know, or Colgan's Command. But because we have to get to like the sixth best version of an effect, you start running into having to actually make an argument for certain card choices over others.
Right. We're also a bit of a split community, right? So, for example, Siggy, I believe, lives in Germany, right? So it's not like he could come explain to the players here in America exactly how to break down Chainveil Teferi or, you know, without video content. It's really hard for people to have that translation. So having primers is really important.
Matchup guides end up being a lot more complicated because there are three other decks at your table.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of dynamism that comes with multiplayer and just pod dynamics, turn order, things along those lines.
Yeah, the difference between a capable mulligan when you're on the play and when you're second, third, or fourth is completely different.
I overall agree with that. I do think that observing your position in the pod kind of determines how well your hand will play out, especially if there are other stack sticks at the table that will play tempo pieces before you have the chance to develop your board, or right. there are decks that want to play early wheels, or somebody develops a Remora before your hand dumps itself out. Things along those lines.
Yeah, I think like there's certain cards and certain almost like groups of cards where that's more relevant. Like against Yisan, it's something I think about, but against
yep.
like Chrom and Timna Opus Thief, it's not really something I worry about. If that yeah, makes sense.
If Stax was more prevalent in the current meta, I think it would be a much more dynamic conversation. But even something as simple as this hand is amazing with a Gemstone Caverns and it's garbage without one.
Yeah, that's true.
Let's be honest, that's most hands with a Gemstone Caverns.
Yeah. That's very true.
Very true. Before we move away from primers, I really want to talk about fringe archetypes. So CEDH is definitely unique as a competitive format in the fact that there are, I believe we're close to 800 legal commanders at the moment. And as much as partners currently dominate the format, as much as we see Timna with either Chrom or Thrasios at the moment, there's still a lot of play with a lot of commanders, and people are always excited to come in with a legendary creature. Like Brayden was talking about earlier, sometimes people take a commander and bring it into competitive EDH. I know personally, when I've been looking at sort of fringe decks, having that part of the primer that introduces why you should play this deck, why you shouldn't play this deck. And while we're on the subject, Shaper, just how do you, as the moderator of the library, look at a primer and, even if it's for a fringe archetype, evaluate, yes, the work being done in this pushes it to a competitive level?
For the purposes of the library, I try to take a very generous outlook on what can be submitted. Anything that intends to sit at a CDH table, is honest about its power level, and is truly optimized to its fullest, I think has a place in the library. There are things in the library that I would consider high power commanders that don't quite reach the bar of what I would consider a competitive deck, but there are tables where those are appropriate, and those primers are intended to optimize those commanders.
And kind of going upon that, I think it's very interesting that a lot of commanders can be made or broken by only a single card. For example, as we talked about in our last episode, the technical viability of 3-mana Kefnet from Amonkhet being considered a potentially competitive commander now because of the printing of Mystic Sanctuary. So had people been doing work beforehand on that, on maybe a high-powered version of the deck, now they can look at that if a card is printed to push something into a competitive frame to really say, oh, okay, this is the work that's been done before. We have brand new tech. Let's use that to get us to that next level.
There are definitely cards that push commanders into competitive viability. The large example is, of course, Godo, who probably straddles the line of competitive. I think he's just over that line. Helm of the Host being printed brought him from being discardable to being a really interesting deck.
Yeah, there's a lot of big Godo fans out there. They're very passionate.
The Godo fans are some of the most passionate I've seen.
It is, I have to say, it is the Discord that I've joined that is probably the most active.
I'm pretty sure the Playing with Power Discord has a secret channel just for Godo, for secret Godo players.
I can't
That's
confirm.
Amazing. That's hilarious. So the next topic we are going to address is the links to the Discords. Competitive EDH tends to find a lot of the innovation and brewing of the decks that are played in competitive EDH on Discord servers. Discord is probably the most active place if you want to be actively talking about competitive EDH. Before, I used to think it was the Reddit until I really discovered the trove that is the Discord servers. And the library has information on basically every single Discord that you could need to talk competitive EDH. So, Shaper, do you want to talk about that a little bit?
I would describe it as a Discord directory. For each archetype and each commander, there tends to be a Discord specifically dedicated to that commander, at least as far as competitively played commanders go. For example, there's an Animar Discord, there's a Yisan Discord, there's an entire Food Chain Discord in which we have channels dedicated to each commander that is able to be infinitely cast with Food Chain. For example, there's a Sliver channel, a Niv channel, a Tazri channel, a Prosh, Omnath, Hullin, Korvold, Maelstrom Wanderer, Sidisi, Gonti, Tishana, a Casual channel, and Ramos.
One interesting thing I found about each deck having a Discord is that you'll find that each community is very different. I've found, like, we kind of mentioned a minute ago that, like the Godo Discord has its own, like, personality. They're all really big fans of Godo. But I've also found, like, the Hulk Discord has a community of its own. the food chain has like a community of its own. Like each archetype has people who are commonly seen around and people you can talk to. And if you're willing to admit that you probably don't know as much as the people who built the decks, it's a very good resource to learn a lot about how to play the decks and maybe poke them and ask them, like, why is it this way and why not this way? Have you considered this? Hey, would you look into this? And that's been extremely rewarding for me personally.
I'd also love to encourage the audience to not be shy in coming in and revealing your tech to us. People tend to be really receptive to new ideas on these Discords.
Yep.
Everyone is always looking to try to make their deck the best it can possibly be. And it's really valuable to talk through even why something isn't strong enough for competitive games.
For example, up until very recently, whenever a new pile came out or a new combo piece that would go into a whole pile came out, there's like a mad rush to be the first person who figures out how to break it and how to make it the best pile. Like there was people trying to make Heliod, the Sun Crown, like how can I make this the best Hulk pile? And it's like really exciting to be on like the literal like bleeding edge of Hulk piles. Sometimes it's very scary too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's a lot
I know specifically as a member of the Elsha Discord, I've been talking with Flash, the guy who runs it, Flash Andretti, and the amount of random ideas I've bounced off of him, and we all have, like, when spoilers come out and everyone's like, so we all agree this is amazing, right? And there's literally, like, you know, a handful of people who are like, yep, we're on it, we got it, we're brewing with it. And as I mentioned earlier, there's actually a great subsection of the library that is completely dedicated to content creators working on competitive Commander. Chaper, do you want to expand on that and how you pick these?
For each content creation group, we have a channel set up for their YouTube feed. So whenever, for example, the Spike Feeders or the Laboratory Maniacs or soon to be the CDH cast, once they get me their YouTube link, whenever they post a new YouTube video, it will automatically post it to the channel. So you can keep up with all of your favorite CDH content creators just by checking in on the Discord every time you're looking for new content to observe.
I know I found actually a certain amount of content creators that I had never heard of just by hopping in on the library. So.
Yeah, every once in a while, I'll see, like, oh, I've never heard of Deck Design or Zona. Like, I'm just looking at it right now. Like,
yeah.
There's a few of these names I don't recognize. Or Ed and EDH. I remember the first time I saw that, I was like, I need to check those guys out.
Zona is a Spanish language channel, which might be why you haven't heard of them before.
Oh, that's cool.
So the next subject we wanted to talk about is how you get to submit content to the library. So luckily, there is a very convenient little channel at the top of the Discord, as I said earlier, that just says hashtag submit. And that's a great place for you to post a primer, for you to post content, for you to post basically anything you think the library should have as a piece of information. Just scrolling through what's up there right now, I see a primer, I see a Discord channel that's brand new. Anything that needs to be filed will be up there for a little bit. Shaper investigates it and throws it up there. And Shaper, you said you have certain expectations that you have when someone submits a new piece of content to you. What would those be?
So primers should be aimed at competitive play or power-optimized high-power play, which really means that your deck is competitive or it's quasi-competitive and it's aimed at an environment that is playing with other competitive decks. You should have a coherent exposition of the strategy. The cards and win conditions should be, you know, fairly easy to draw out of that. Decks should be aimed at power optimization, so they shouldn't cards shouldn't be selected for reasons other than trying to make your deck as powerful as it can be. Primers should elucidate the primary strategy of the deck. This includes treatment of the main combos, their methods of interactions and interplay with the other decks at the table, or not, and general play advice. They should also contain explanations of important or surprising cards and exclusions, and there should be attention to detail in your formatting, spelling, and all that. Generally, we expect there to be 1,500 words or more.
Now, when you say your first consideration needs to be power, you mean if you can't afford a Time Twister, you should still include it in your primer list, because the primer is for almost like budgetless CDH, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Great. So you said when talking to us earlier that you're hoping to get more submissions for the library and hoping to grow it.
Yes, I would love people that have expertise in any particular deck to submit their primers to the library. If you need help with writing or editing a primer, we are more than happy to help you create something that you can share with the community.
Are there any primer guides or any like...
Yes, there are two. There are two primers. There's Maynard Ferguson's A Primer on Primers, and there's M. McGeech's What Should I Put in My Primer?
Great. And where can these be found?
They can be found in the welcome channel of the library, which I recommend you read when you join.
Yeah, usually those are pretty important. I think being able to have this resource available to the community is pretty imperative. I was talking with Brayden when I was actually introduced to the library by him. So I had been playing CEDH for probably about 6 months at that point, and I had actually never heard of the library. Even though I was deep into Discords and Reddit, I just hadn't been aware of this resource, which is one of the reasons we really wanted to bring it to everyone's attention here today, because having been exposed to this resource, I have gained so much knowledge, and just being able to see all the different people trying these different archetypes and really expanding them to their fullest potential has really helped me as a brewer in CEDH.
If you need orientation in the library, feel free to ask questions in Lounge, which we are happy to point you in the right direction for the resources that you're looking for if you can't find something. A lot of the time when people post in Lounge, we actually create resources for them, either Discords for the commanders that they're looking for, or we can point them to people that we know play a certain deck but haven't necessarily written a primer yet.
That's awesome. In addition to all of the qualities that we mentioned before, the library also includes things like community hubs, things like the competitive EDH Reddit Discord. There's a Play EDH Discord, which for those who do not actually know what that is, it's a place where people can play competitive EDH over webcam in a way that allows them to play with people not in the same location. So you get four people on a webcam trying to play games. Transitioning out of the library, we are now going to switch gears and talk about a pretty insane spoiler that we just got from Theros Beyond Death. The card's name is
Thassa's Oracle. Thassa's Oracle is a merfolk wizard for blue-blue, and it's a 1/3. It has an Enter the Battlefield effect that says, when it enters the battlefield, look at the top X cards of your library, where X is your devotion to blue. Put one of them on top of your library and the rest on the bottom of your library in any order. If X is greater than or equal to the number of cards in your library, you win the game. This card is insane. Just absurd.
Absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
So this card is very important to the competitive EDH format because of a couple reasons. Basically, this card is one of the most optimized win conditions that the competitive format has ever seen. And it also cohesively gels with some of the best win conditions that we already have by making them less affected by specific hate pieces that normally our decks would rely on to be able to stop these cards.
So the direct comparison to this card is Laboratory Maniac, which you may know as if you draw from an empty library, you win the game. In CDH, that pairs with a card called Demonic Consultation, which is name a card, exile the top six, and then exile cards until you find the card that you named, and you have the ability to name a card that's not in your library, and that will exile your library.
And one of the reasons that Thassa's Oracle is immediately better than Laboratory Maniac is the fact that its ability hits the stack, and you don't need that additional draw to trigger the win condition. As soon as you exile your library with the trigger on the stack, the Oracle will check, see that there's no more cards in your library, and you just win the game right there.
Also, because it's worded so specifically that if your devotion is equal to the number of cards in your library, you win the game, even if they kill your Thassa's Oracle and you have no devotion, you still win the game.
Comparing this to Laboratory Maniac, you don't need to generate an extra draw, you don't need the permanent in play, and it costs one less mana to execute the entire combo.
Yeah, so there's three ways that this spell is optimized over Laboratory Maniac.
In just this single situation.
Recently in War of the Spark, we also got Jace Wielder of Mysteries that generates his own draw, but has a converted mana cost of 4 and triple blue, so it's quite more difficult to cast than Thassa's Oracle.
We did talk a great deal in the last episode about when Jace was printed and how it changed the equation. This new card throws all of that, wow, Jace is so much better stuff out of the park, because now the downsides of Lab Maniac that we were talking about in that last episode are irrelevant to the Oracle. Even though it's a creature win con, as soon as that trigger hits the stack, it doesn't matter what happens to that creature.
Additionally, a thing we specifically talked about was the more versions of this effect you have, the safer these exile some portion of your deck cards become. And so this being a third copy is also very relevant.
Not only is it a powerful standalone combo, but it has important implications with Flash Hulk, which is a combo in which you cast the spell Flash, and it puts into play and sacrifices a card called Protean Hulk, which allows you to get 6 converted mana cost of creatures out of your library and put them into play immediately. One example pile that you could make with a Protean Hulk is getting a Laboratory Maniac, a card called Spellseeker that would find an instant for converted mana cost 2 or less, which would find the Demonic Consultation, and you would be able to pass into your turn, cast a Demonic Consultation in your upkeep, and move into your draw step.
You had to put resources into casting the Demonic Consultation and resources into drawing the card, or you had to wait until your draw step, which is on its own very risky. This card improves upon that, because now you just put a Thassa's Oracle into play with a Spellseeker, tutor for Demonic Consultation just like you did before, exile your deck in response to the Thassa's Oracle trigger, you remove your deck from the game, and now the Thassa's Oracle trigger resolves. You don't need to draw a card, you don't need to put extra resources into it, and you immediately win the game. There's a whole bunch of removal spells that would have worked against that pile in the past that are now completely dead because Thassa's Oracle is a trigger, just like we mentioned earlier.
Yeah, and one thing in particular that makes this line so terrifying is the fact that you don't have to wait for the extra draw, and you don't have to wait for that specific time in your turn, meaning you could be in a pod where, say, someone has just tried to go off with an ad nauseum and it was countered, and there's only one person holding up mana, and at the end step of the player before them, they tap out for something like a Fact or Fiction. Suddenly, everyone's tapped out for that one moment. You suddenly have the ability to win right then and there, between phases, at someone's end step, when someone's tapped out at the wrong time. It is so powerful to be able to just snap that win off. And the innovation with this Oracle is the fact that a lot of the hate pieces you could jam before that would really stop this effect are no longer relevant.
We've given an overview that uses Spellseeker and Demonic Consultation to empty your library, but that is not actually the most powerful thing that you can do with Thassa's Oracle and Protean Hulk. Importantly, you can get what's called the Breakfast Combo, which is Nomad's End Core and Cephalid Illusionist, which together create a combo that lets you arbitrarily mill your deck in batches of 3 cards. That allows you to mill out your deck without ever having to cast another spell like Demonic Consultation, so you are immune to counterspells after your Protean Hulk.
As well as a common play against the Spellseeker pile in the past was casting a Silence in response to it so that you can't cast your consult until the next turn. Now, with this Breakfast pile, where you just mill yourself without casting a spell, you're immune to Silence, which is pretty powerful.
Right, and even if they are holding up that removal spell, as we said, the Oracle makes that no longer an issue. You can kill the Oracle, you can kill any card in the pile, and it's not going to do anything.
You can actually respond if they try to kill one of your mill creatures. You can just respond and mill your deck, so you're just completely immune.
Now with the Oracle being printed and the lines that everyone just described a moment ago, the previous Hulk piles or combinations of the 6 converted mana cost cards have become basically irrelevant. There have been weaknesses that each of the piles have had before, and now with these new piles basically all thrown out the window, this new Hulk archetype, which is being cutely called Fish Hulk by the community, is now suddenly the best way to play the Flash Hulk archetype. And Flash has already been a card that the community has been asking for a ban for quite a bit of time now, but this issue has really pushed it to the forefront.
The Oracle Hulk piles allow deck construction to be much higher card quality and much less interactable than any previous Hulk deck, and now is very attractive to combine with Consultation, which has historically been a separate archetype from Hulk in the past. This new deck allows you to win at instant speed for no additional resources with no board state before you assemble Flash and Hulk.
The Thassa's Oracle Hulk piles are so resilient and so resource light that they push the Flash Hulk archetype further towards sandbagging and further towards basically doing nothing, that it forces your opponents to constantly respect it, and it makes it more difficult for people to actually play Magic against the Flash Hulk.
Yeah,
decks.
One thing specifically with the competitive format is a lot of people will say turn 1 and turn 2 are really devoted to both ramping and setting up the resources that you're going to need for the remainder of the game. But if starting at 2 mana, your opponent can just slam down a win right there, you have to respect that at all times, which creates this mentality that Brayden was talking about where everyone has to be respecting it at all times, meaning as early as turn 2, you can't continue to further your board state because you are holding up counter magic in case someone tries to win with the Flash combo.
Additionally, Thassa's Oracle plus Demonic Consultation not requiring any type of draw trigger means that outside of the Flash Hulk combo, it still only costs you 3 mana to go off. So you can go off as early as turn 1 or turn 2 with protection like Force of Will or Force Negation. So it's incredibly powerful.
A lot of playing Flash Hulk successfully is waiting until your opponent's interaction has depleted and flashing on top of whatever caused that counter war to happen. So when somebody plays a Sorcery Speed Wincon on their turn, people will attempt to let it not resolve or try to remove it before the combo has been successfully executed. And once the Flash player senses that all the interaction has been depleted, they'll put their Flash on top of the problematic spell. And so that leads to a lot of what we'd call sandbagging, which is you assemble your combo in your hand and you wait for an opportune moment to Flash the Hulk.
That gameplay style is very problematic for the health of the format.
Yeah, the idea that everyone is sitting there waiting with these spells, not playing the game, but actively sandbagging because they have to wait. They have to hold up mana. They have to hold up counterspells. They have to hold up their own flash if they're on the archetype. So it just leads to everyone sitting there doing nearly nothing. And really creating these unfun board states because the game isn't being played. Everyone's staring at each other, hoping for someone to slip up.
And this is one of the reasons that it's very popular in the competitive EDH community to ask the rules committee to ban a card like Flash, because it causes these problematic gameplay patterns that many people just honestly don't enjoy.
One of the reasons why this style of gameplay is problematic is that Flash is one of the only instant speed win conditions in the format. So to play this instant speed sandbag game, you must be playing Flash Hulk.
Right.
The only other deck that does anything like that is Consultation, where in the past, maybe you'd play out your Jace and use it as like a draw engine, and then use your Consult plus a instant speed draw effect like Thrasios, so that you can win the game at instant speed on top of maybe even the Flash Hulk deck. But that's incredibly resource intensive, and you're always open to having your Jace bounced in response to the draw trigger that was on the stack, and then you just lose because you draw a card with an empty
right.
library.
The consult resource allocation is significantly more than what is needed for just two mana in this flash pile. And as we said earlier, the printing of Oracle really makes it so that any interaction being done with these piles is nearly irrelevant, which is such a problem.
One problem that Thassa's Oracle also introduces to the format is that a lot of the times the hate for these consultation decks isn't actually very good against these Flash Hulk decks. And now because both decks are the same, there's a concern that once you turn off one half the deck, the other half of the deck is just live and ready to fire. For example, I play consultation decks that don't play Flash Hulk, and I often lose to cards like Back to Basics and Blood Moon. A Flash Hulk deck only needs one blue source to win the game, a blue and a generic. So if they have a mana dork and a basic island, they can very easily just win the game out of nowhere while everyone's resources are shut out by Back to Basics or Blood Moon, and no one can interact with them.
I was going to say, another thing that's important there is that with the printing of Narset in War of the Spark, that has been a really good piece to shutting down these consultation lines before, because you needed a draw for the win condition. So there were times when you've already drawn a card that turn, meaning that you could not draw any additional cards, and therefore Narset was a really good hate piece to shut down consult win.
Luckily, your good friend Thrasios was
bad. Very true.
Exactly. But even if you're playing around a Narset in a consultation deck up until today, you had to have your piece already in play and enough mana to activate your draw effect, which is far more than the one in a blue that these Consultation Hulk decks are going to be able to play.
Which is interestingly enabled by this sandbag playstyle that stretches games out into the very late game where people have mana to execute these large mana combos.
Exactly. So a lot of the time, people will mention that their problems with the format include Consult and Hulk. They see Consult as just as good as Hulk. But in reality, the play patterns that Hulk forces people into are actually the exact play patterns that consultation decks want to be playing into. And so as Flash has gotten better, consultation has also gotten better. If the game is constantly being delayed due to people being afraid of overextending, you're going to have way more mana, and you'll be able to activate Thrasios three or four times to draw a card in response to removal.
Right. So because of this new Hulk pile from Thassa's Oracle, it will have a resonating effect on the format, and right now we're going to break that down into each way that it's going to be affected moving forward. So Shaper, do you want to break down the effect that it's going
to
have?
To start with, these are probably the most powerful Hulk piles that we've seen thus far, and it makes running the previous Hulk piles much, much, much less attractive, to the point where you probably would prefer to an Oracle list. So Shuffle Hulk, Sacred Hulk, Breakfast Hulk probably all want to optimize into a Thassa's Oracle pile.
And what about the consultation decks, like Consultation Scepter Thrasios and Dockside Consultation?
Consultation Scepter Thrasios' claim to fame was the sheer card quality that you get from running the win conditions that it had. With how Thassa's Oracle has optimized these Hulk piles, the card quality of the Hulk decks is now near equivalent to what was possible with CST, so it makes the Isochron Scepter line as a sorcery speed win con that costs 4 much less attractive as well, so those decks will probably optimize into playing Flash Hulk as well, similar to any Kenrith build of infinite mana.
And so with these innovations, we're really looking for a list right now to display exactly what this new archetype is going to be, even before the card's actually printed. So Shaper, I know you've been working as part of a team that's hoping to get a primer and maybe even a deck list out right now. Do you want to go into that?
Yes. So I developed a list called Fish Hulk. Sick Robot of Shuffle Hulk fame also created a list that was only a few cards off of mine. His was entitled Sushi Hulk. And we've worked on many decks together in the past, and we've assembled a team of Sick Robot, Sleepy, who worked on CST with me, Pongo of Team Term 3, Siggy of Laboratory Maniacs, and Lurker to work on this list. The main thing we're looking to do is to put together certain modules that would push your deck in a certain direction, either mid-rangey control or value or attacking artifacts in your meta or playing wheels and Notion Thief because other people are doing similar things and you want to prey on their wheels with your Notion Thief. So we're looking to assemble a really large maybe board of cards that will help you customize this shell to your tastes. We found our core to be close to 90 to 92 cards, so that's about 8 flex slots where we all would probably play like slightly different packages on top of this deck.
I saw some people playing Neoform, which is a card we talked about on our last episode. What's your opinion on that in the list?
It's personally not one that I would choose, but it's very powerful with Grand Abolisher, turning your dork into basically becoming uninteractable.
That's very powerful. Wow. I had not considered
that. They also need to respond to the Neoform before they know what your target is, or else it's too late. Dork into Gilded Drake is also a very powerful play. And now dork into Thassa's Oracle can allow you to try to win on the spot as well.
What do you guys think as to the rise of potential Torpor Orb effects coming out of this?
I think it's unlikely because Torpor Orb doesn't affect Laboratory Maniac or Jace. One of the great difficulties of fighting off this list is that any of the angles that let you attack Hulk will generally not attack consultation-wise directly. Interesting parallels to Torpor Orb are Hushwing Griff, which is a flyer that stops Enter the Battlefield effects and draws cards with Timna. We may see some of that. It also has Flash, costs 3. The card that I do think we'll probably see some play is Hushbringer, which stops both Death Triggers and Enters the Battlefield abilities, so it shuts off Thassa's Oracle and Hulk. The problem with it tends to be that it does shut off a lot of your own win cons in pretty much anything you play it in, so it's hard to find a great home for it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because in the past there were, and there still will be, but in the past there were decks that were in white that were consultless that could play a card like Hushbringer because they didn't play anything that had ETB effects or death triggers. But now, because of the amount of like homogenization in the format, those deck lists that used to exist, like the mid-range consultation lists, might not be able to play those cards, which is actually kind of interesting to me. What do you think of that?
I think that makes sense. I think it fits into Timna Krom pretty easily. I also think it fits into Food Chain Sliver if you are facing a lot of these effects, though Sliver tends to take a more proactive plan than trying to play reactive cards like Hushbringer. I believe an Ajila can run Hushbringer. There's a lot of talk about whether Stifle effects are now more attractive with a potential rise of Fish Hulk.
If you were to try to think of a deck that exists today that tried to combat this deck, is there any deck that actually does it effectively, do you think?
Opus Thief has some advantages insofar as disrupting the sandbag player's sculpt is quite strong. Putting pieces that they want to Hulk into play into other zones like the graveyard can also be somewhat disruptive. Cursed Totem and Torpor Orb. Suppression Field is a pretty powerful tool against the Breakfast Pile.
As well as just Thassios as a grinded plan. Taking it from 4 to 6 mana is actually quite a lot.
Attacking their value engines in general tends to slow their ability to assemble the combo.
Just to expand sort of on what Shaper said there, especially the disrupting of the sculpt, the Opus Thief deck uses wheel effects such as Wheel of Fortune, Time Twister, Windfall to gain advantage with effects like Smothering Tide, Narset, Notion Thief, etc. And a lot of the time, these Hulk decks will try and tutor up their Flash effect, tutor up their Hulk, and just sit it with there in their hand like we talked about earlier. But by casting wheel effects, you have now disrupted that plan because the hand that they had sculpted is now either shuffled back into their library or pitched into their graveyard.
I've also found the five-color decks of Food Chain Sliver and Najila to be good picks into heavy Hulk hate metas, where people are spending a lot of resources developing permanents that would interact with Hulk, they tend to not do anything to the Food Chain deck and Gila.
Yeah, that's a really great point. When the table is forced to spend resources on cards like Graftdigger's Cage that stops the Protean Hulk trigger from effectively working, that is extra time that decks that maybe are trying to get under those decks can win, where the Flash deck can't win through their Graftdigger's Cage, and the other players are tapped out because they've played this hate. It'll be interesting to see how the meta adapts in that way. Are there going to be more decks that are trying to prey on the decks that are trying to stop the Hulk deck?
One idea that I had that I haven't fully developed is the potential to play instant speed draw in response to the Oracle trigger.
Unlike Labman, where it's a replacement effect on drawing a card, they still have to draw the cards, and they can die. Another card I've seen people talking about is Angel's Grace. You can't win the game if an opponent has cast Angel's Grace. So a lot of people have talked about just playing the Angel's Grace, which is a card that has split second that says your opponents can't win the game and you can't lose the game. So because it has split second, you can't really respond to it. And now your trigger resolves. It does nothing because you can't win the game. And you have to pass the turn. And now you have no way of putting cards back into your deck. So when you draw during your next turn, you just die.
Yeah.
So that's a card people are considering playing. And it does pair very well with the existing farm decks that were trying to prey on the consultation lists that currently exist. Leptis just wrote a huge article for the Lab Maniacs about that. That was very interesting that we can link in the description. I think that's an interesting attack on the format.
So we talked recently about how these Oracle Hulk lines are actually pretty problematic for the format going forward, and how they really push Flash to even more of an oppressive place than it's ever been. We're going to dive into why this is really a problem for the format and why you've noticed a lot of CDH players sounding the alarm about this card. So, Shaper, do you want to start us off?
Since Hulk was unbanned, I was an advocate of banning Flash. I don't think it produces healthy play patterns in CDH, and I think it distinctly is a cut above most other win cons in a way that imbalances the game. I do think that with the printing of Thassa's Oracle, there's going to be an immense amount of centralization within the Hulk and consultation archetypes, and kind of a merger into this new Fish Hulk style deck. We will lose out on a lot of format diversity as a result, both due to how powerful it is pushing out other decks and how you are kind of forced to interact with it on the axis that it demands you to.
It is unfortunately, in addition to the format, that right now looks like it has nothing of a downside. Brayden, do you want to dive into it anymore?
Yeah, I guess my opinion is that Flash is seriously problematic to the format. I think that over time, as Magic grows and gets older, they're going to print cards that get broken with Flash. It's kind of like how in Modern there was a card called Birthing Pod, and they banned it because it prevented them from printing good creatures. Thassa's Oracle is not the problem. I want to be very clear. It's definitely problematic that Magic is a game where they're going to keep printing creatures, and Hulk is going to keep being able to search them up. They have been really great in the last few years about printing cards like Hushbringer, like Graftdigger's Cage, like Rest in Peace, Leyline of the Void, these cards. I think it's a great sign that they printed a creature that has Torpor Orb and a Death Triggers counter to it. It shows that they're willing to put two stacks effects on one permanent, which is really what's going to have to happen to band-aid this problem.
So I'll just say real quick, I also agree that Thassa's Oracle is not the problem. It is definitely Flash.
So it's just very frustrating that it's such an easy-to-solve problem, and it just isn't going to be solved immediately.
I also agree that it's a very easy to solve problem, and with really any education about higher power level aspects of the format, it becomes very obvious that Flash is problematic to CDH in general, and I feel like the effective cost of banning Flash for lower power commander is extremely small. It's a card that, when used for the purposes of flashing in a creature, is honestly worse than a lot of the other effects that have gotten printed in New World Order Magic, such as Savage Summoning and whatnot. So I don't think that there is any meaningful cost to banning this for casual EDH.
I guess I'll say this now. I think something that is very important to remember when going into these conversations, especially about bans, things that can be changed in the format, is that every person on this phone call, every person who plays competitive EDH, is not playing competitive EDH. They are playing Commander EDH at the highest level that the cards will allow them to play. CEDH is slang. People who love playing at this style, at this power level, it is a tool for us to talk to other people and know that they are enjoying the game the same way that we are. but it's not its own format. And as far as I know, a lot of people don't want it to be its own thing because we are EDH players. We like playing the best EDH has to offer, but we are still EDH players. And there seems to be a divide in the community because CEDH is seen as its own thing, but it's not. We want to take this format that we love. We love Commander. We love this idea that you have this general and 99 cards to play at the best power level we can. That's why we come in here. We've had this discussion ahead of time by playing CEDH. We say we are CEDH players, and we all know on the hypothetical number scale that we are all coming with a 9 deck or a 10 deck ready to play at that level. That's just us having a conversation. It doesn't mean we're doing something different. We are playing under the guise and under the rules of Commander. And I think going upon that into these conversations moving forward about bans, about, quote, representation of the CEDH community, I think it's important. Just because people like playing at different power levels doesn't mean they're playing a different game. We are all playing Commander. We are all playing EDH. We are all joining for basically the same reason, that we love the EDH format. And just because we like different spectrums of the format does not mean that we are not still attaining the same goal. I have had the most jovial conversations ever playing Commander, playing CEDH. We still sit around the table, we laugh, sometimes we drink, it is a social game. And just because people like winning doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with that. Another small note is I personally was playing a ton of casual EDH. It was my favorite thing to do. But as Magic has become a stronger format, I was being frustrated by the discrepancy at the power levels. But knowing that I can go to a CEDH tournament and play one level and know that everyone there is respecting the environment enough to be playing at that same level is so relieving. Like, I know Brayden and Shaper, if I play against you guys, we are all on the same level and we know exactly the decks that we're going to play. Not the list specifically, but we know that we're all attaining that same goal. So CEDH is just a way of communicating what we want as players. So I just feel like that's an important message to get out there.
Yeah, I really strongly agree, to be honest. I think there's this like confusion that just because we put a C next to EDH, that the C is the most important part. It's not really the important part of it. The important part is that we just have a name to call what we're doing. CEDH, it's really just EDH. We're playing EDH. I think our goals are extremely aligned. If you read the philosophy document, I think we align very strongly with everything there, except for that last line or two that says the fun of Commander is not breaking it. And I disagree. I think the fun of Commander is breaking it. But I don't think everyone else has to feel that way.
I will say, even that last part about breaking it, I would argue that competitive EDH is not breaking the format. It's optimizing the format.
Shaper, have any thoughts?
Yeah, let me try. I think with the printing of Thassa's Oracle, we're at a pretty pivotal moment in CEDH history in which a lot of, at the risk of sounding alarmist, a lot of the top tier decks are kind of converging on a very similar package of win cons, and they are so lean that a lot of the staples look really similar. And I do think that's pretty problematic for our format in general. I think Flash is the locus of the problem, and I feel like really the RC and the CAG should care about competitive EDH, not even necessarily for its own sake, not even necessarily for CEDH players, but because we are all playing the same format. There just will be EDH events. There will be EDH played for prizes. I think the future of event EDH is really important, and I feel like the RC turning a blind eye to everything that's kind of tautologically above a certain power level because it is CEDH is fairly wrongheaded. I think that to some degree the job of the ban list is to basically force people to play at a similar power level, and with specifically Flash being a cut above literally everything else, I feel like they should take note of that and should take action on that.
Do you think the success of competitive EDH is tied to the success of casual EDH, I guess?
I do directly. I think a lot of the people that come to join to play competitive EDH were at one point casual players or players that got into the format without understanding all of this power level baggage that we have kind of built up around these different dialogues. They're just Magic players, and one of the things about playing Magic is optimizing your deck and trying to make it the best you can be and trying to beat your friends and trying to come up with this spicy new deck that nobody else thought of. And that's all just a natural optimization. That's just the natural power creep of the way every format works. I don't know. I don't necessarily want to frame it this way, but I do think that a lot of the entrenched Commander players kind of lose sight of what it is to be a new player and not really care about gating your own power level or not really seeing why that's necessary. Some experienced Magic players can get together and all decide that they want to play around the 7-8 power level and not play the very best things, but all play really explosive, interesting decks with a lot of synergies. But when you're a new player, you don't really understand that. You just see your opponent's deck and you think about how good their Sword of Fire and Ice is and how it triggers their Enraged Dinosaur and whatnot. And you try to find those little synergies and you try to put them together. And as you research, you come into more and more powerful things.
I got to say, something you brought up there is really, I think, integral to this conversation, that I would argue the people who grab a pre-con and play four of those are technically doing the same thing that CEDH players do on a regular basis, in the sense that you are coming in with this, like, pre-cons are designed to play with each other, right? That is literally, they are introductions to the format and they're designed to play with each other. Competitive EDH decks, they're on that high power level, but the competitive EDH meta is designed to play with each other. It's still Commander. It's just different, once again, different colors of the spectrum.
That's a really fascinating concept. I never really crossed my mind, but I think you're absolutely correct.
So all of that aside, we actually have a super secret project that Shaper has a little call out for.
Yes, I would love to have anyone that is interested in compiling and aggregating CEDH data to reach out to me and perhaps work with me on some projects that I have that I think will greatly benefit the community and help people get up and running with CEDH in general and deck building and all that other great stuff.
I've gotten a sneak peek, and it's super exciting. So if you're interested, you should reach out to Shaper.
Well, it's been a big week for Magic as far as these Theros Beyond Death spoilers, and we're really happy to have had Shaper on to this episode because having him as a figure of this community has been amazing, and we're just glad to have him. So, Shaper, thanks for coming and joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was wonderful being on your show. I'm glad I can help you springboard your projects.
Thanks, man.
Thanks so much, man.
Great. So thank you from all of us here at the CEDH cast. Brayden, before we sign off, do you want to give us some social media whereabouts?
Sure. So you can find us at CEDHcast on Twitter and on Instagram. And also you can find our Patreon in the links down below. And we also are now on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and SoundCloud. All CEDHcast there.
Great. And hopefully, as we kind of talked about earlier in the episode, we will be on YouTube very soon. So from all of us here at the CEDH cast, thank you very much and hope you have a great time.
Awesome. See you in the library.